DW Africa Link.
In our globalized world, where borders seem more connected than ever, millions of people are on the move, fleeing conflict, persecution, or simply seeking greener pastures. Yet, migration often sparks fear, divisions, and hostility towards the foreigners. Nowhere is that evident in Africa than in South Africa, where xenophobic tensions have escalated in recent years. So how do these struggles reflect the larger global migration crisis? That's what we shall seek to find out in this episode. My name is Josie Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from Africa.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
Xenophobia in South Africa has complex roots, largely tied to the country's socio-economic and political history. It began intensifying after apartheid ended in 1994, when South Africa transitioned to a democracy and became a major destination for migrants across Africa. The influx of immigrants, particularly from countries like Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Nigeria, created competition for jobs, housing, and social services in a country already grappling with high unemployment, inequality, and poverty. In 2008, xenophobic violence erupted, leading to a series of attacks against foreign nationals. It marked one of the most severe outbreaks of attacks on non-South Africans. What exactly needs to be done to eradicate this problem in South Africa? Joining me for this discussion is our correspondent in Johannesburg, Thuso Khumalo, and Nombulelo Jakinkweni, a communications and media consultant at the Women in Diaspora Association, WIDA. Welcome to the program. I'll start with you right away, Jacqueline. Can you just tell us a little bit of xenophobia's history in South Africa?
It would be difficult to talk about the history of xenophobia because I live here and I'm just part of this whole mix. And sometimes we do not know where things started. But I have been here for 27 years. And the first time I had experience with xenophobia was in 2008. I didn't directly experience it. But I was lucky enough to be living in a suburb where there wasn't too much foot traffic. But I was living right across Zuzumane on the periphery of Alexandra.
All right. So can you take us through the activities that particular time, even though you were in the suburb?
By the time we got aware of it, it was at night. Apparently, it had started the previous day. So we were just chilling. And then all of a sudden, there's screams and, you know, those distant noises where there's chaos. It was very traumatic for me. Even now, I don't want to think about it. But when events unfolded, some of them were visible from where we lived because we lived on the last house on the last street. So we could see across Alex, people running. One thing that would never leave me, there was a lady who was running. She was carrying stuff and she had a baby on her back. And you know how when the baby's towel starts loosening, it was loosening. And she was trying to save herself and her baby. That stayed with me because I had a small baby. And I that was just so bad. So obviously it developed overnight. It developed the next day, like just escalated and escalated. So at the time I was living with my aunt in Soweto. It's my sister who was living in Kelvin. So I was with my sister at the time. So I was even afraid to go back home in Soweto, and I was afraid to stay there. It was very traumatic because a lot of people were not aware that it was going to happen. So, yeah, it was really bad. It was really bad.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, Thuso, you've been reporting on this story, these stories for so many years in South Africa, xenophobia's history. Tell us in your own opinion.
Yeah, as Jake said, it all went full blast in 2008. Before that, there were no incidents that were prominent about foreign nationals fighting with South Africans. But 2008, what happened was there was political chaos in Zimbabwe. A lot of Zimbabweans came into South Africa by numbers. So I think that overwhelmed South Africans, because according to Home Affairs, about around 200,000 people just all of a sudden came into South Africa because of the economic situation and political situation that emanated from elections in Zimbabwe. So when it erupted, South Africans were going in groups in different places across the country. I remember in Alexandra, an incident that happened where they were going in door by door into the shacks, and there's this Mozambican guy. Some of these incidents, they were filming them, and they were just kniving him on the head. And those were the scenes. And some people were burnt alive, shops were being vandalized. The thing is, when we went around reporting this story, we find groups of people seeking shelter at police stations. Some of them couldn't reach there because these crowds were large. To be frank, tens of thousands of people were displaced, even according to government's own records during that time. So it was a time when, being a foreigner, they would meet you on the way, ask you to speak in South African languages. If they see you too dark to be South African, that's according to them, you'd be victims. This is why even out of the 62 people that were killed, there were South Africans that were killed, not by the foreign nationals, but by South Africans who mistook them for being too dark to be South Africans, and they got into that. So it's a time that happened, but it wasn't only then. We had that in the following years. 2015 became more distinct, with almost over six people being killed again. So it has always been happening. But I think what has made it even more difficult to fight is that authorities have failed to acknowledge that that was xenophobic violence. They try to hide behind terms and do all other things. So because no action is being taken against that as xenophobia, it has been very difficult for authorities to find that.
Yeah, it's so unbelievable that people would term that you're South African or a foreigner because of your complexion too. So, but how has the media's portrayal of foreign nationals in South Africa influenced public perception and potentially fueled xenophobic sentiments?
And to be fair to the media, media has always pointed it out as xenophobia, as xenophobic violence. They've always stated that, although authorities have resisted. I mean, we have had instances where every time this erupts, we have got media there exposing it for what it is. The one in 2015, I think, it went to there's a suburb or township that's next to Johannesburg Center that's called GP. And the whole stretch of road is full of car selling places and car panel beating places, largely owned by Nigerian nationals. So they swept onto over that street and burnt almost everything. Yeah, it ran into millions. But you had the media coming in, the different type from the local media, foreign media. They exposed it for what it is. But I think as media, this is how far you can go.
Yeah, that is exactly what we want to touch on now, Jacqueline. We hear there is something terrible happening now, and it looks like xenophobia is starting to become an issue again. Why are women's rights groups protesting?
Xenophobia is quite a broad terrain. And to be frank, I don't think that there is anyone who has been, especially in this part of the continent maybe, there's no one who is properly geared up to deal with it. When xenophobic attacks started in 2008, there was a lull between then and the 2015 xenophobic attacks that Tuso was mentioning. And during that time, people seemed to think that it's gone. And there has been no move by the government or humanitarian organizations to gear themselves up for that kind of flare-up. Because even what is happening now, even if it abates and we move on, we now know that it is a cancer that is in society. But no one is prepared to address it, because no one knows how to address it, because there is an influx of immigrants. There is a shortage of jobs. Unemployment is very high, not only in South Africa, but across the world. Resources are very limited. So no one will want to share their resources with anyone if they can find a reason not to. So in that vein, before I answer your question, I will want to comment on what Tuso has said about the media coverage, that the media is doing the best that they can to cover xenophobia. I think in the previous incidences, they were covering it. But I personally feel that there has been a deliberate reluctance to report on proper xenophobic attacks when they're happening. Because sometimes I hear about it in my circles and it is so bad that you are surprised that it's not in the news. A case in point is the burning of a gentleman a year or two ago. He was attacked. There was some kind of a criminal element happening there for a while. Some policemen were killed and there was thuggery, the usual reasons they give. And then they caught this man and everyone in that society, they just knew, like, you know a person when he lives in your neighborhood. They knew he wasn't a criminal. They knew he had done nothing. He died for being a Zimbabwean person. And I thought that it was going to make the news. I thought that even the Minister of Home Affairs would step up and be like, okay, guys, this is how we're going to do this. But nobody from the government stepped up sufficiently enough to condemn that act. And there is a similar act that happened again this year, apparently with four gentlemen, but I do not have any details that are like concrete on that, so I'm not going to comment on it. But in the Nyati story, in the story of that man who was burned alive in Deep Slot, he had a young wife, and that wife had a baby. And because I do have connections with these organizations, I had fresh tapes on, like, they put her on tape and she was crying so bad. And she was just saying she's going home, she's never coming back because this man was the breadwinner. She's so afraid for her life. She is so traumatized. She's a woman. She's now going to have to go back home to a home that she doesn't have because that gentleman was working in the gardens. So he didn't work and earn enough to build a home back home. So she had literally nowhere to go. And she had children. So you see how it affects women and children. Now that man has been burned alive, 5 or 7 people have been caught and they are going to court. But what is the welfare organizations in South Africa saying or doing about the children that are left behind with that trauma of having seen or heard their father being burned alive? But that story is not just one story. It is a mirror of the many stories. You pick up a guy that's in a taxi. You're saying, okay, you don't have papers. We're sending you back home. You throw them into a jail in Sun City. Nobody goes back to look who he left home because now locking up a mom or a dad because you found them working in a restaurant, what if they're breastfeeding a baby? What if they are taking children to school? Who's going to take care of those kids? Do those kids then get bundled up with them, sent back home, or they become the problem of the wife that is now staying here?
Yeah. So, Tuso, you know, Jackie just mentioned something that the media is now becoming reluctant. What's your comment on that?
Yeah, I think I also touched on that, of late we have seen media taking a backseat. Some of those incidents happen and there is no much limelight as it used to happen. Let me just give you a brief of what is happening now. I spoke to Sharon Ikambaram from the Lawyers for Human Rights about what is happening now. She described it as institutionalized xenophobia. This is where you find groups or teams of government people from Labor Department, from Home Affairs, from police. They go, you find them, they block a street and they start all of a sudden checking if you've got a passport, if you've got documents, if your passport is valid, and people are rounded up. They go into restaurants, inside a mall, and they go in there, they seal all the exits and they start checking people. They even put handcuffs on them and throw them into vans and all those things. What that has done is it has excited the masses here in South Africa. Fine, on social media, people are so big saying, please arrest them. This is what we want. We don't want them here. So it's fueling what exactly happened in 2008, where people were saying, please, these immigrants, send them out. And when they were not sent out, then people started to take the law into their own hands. So organizations, this is what they are saying. They are saying, although the government has the right to arrest these people, to deport them because of immigration laws, but the way it is being done now, it is just done in a way that excites those emotions that would lead us into a situation that's uncontrolled. Then when you come to the media, what I've seen as far as those events are happening, even though they are reporting on what is happening, those raids, those roadblocks, those searches, that's where they stop. They don't go into the way these guys are treated. Some of these guys, if you look at social media pictures, they are seen being beaten by these officials. One guy in Santin was kicked so hard that he had to be hospitalized for some time. But of course, these are some of the incidents that do not come out. People are saying, okay, this is immigration taking place. But if you speak to these organizations, they will tell you this is a xenophobia being
implemented by the government. Sometimes it also affects even people with papers, because you hear them saying, okay, we take you to the police, Home Affairs is going to come and verify. 2 days you are sitting there in the cells and your papers are fine. After those, they say, sorry, you can go back. So that on its own is infringing on some human rights in the name of implementing immigration laws. And that seemed not to be coming sharp from the media to scrutinize how the government is doing this. Is it doing it according to book? Is it doing it with hatred? Is it doing it in a way that could influence and spike xenophobic violence?
But where are the human rights lawyers? I'm so sure that if someone is unlawfully arrested, they can sue the government.
They do come in. They do come in. Like when I spoke to Ikambaram, she said if they get those cases, they quickly move in. They come in. But like what is happening now, you find there are teams in Rustenburg, there are teams in Pretoria, there are teams. So it's even difficult for them to keep the pace. And also when these guys are arrested, they don't have means of communicating. I'm here, and most of them, they have no papers. What is happening now, the most painful thing is that these guys go in, round up people, especially on the streets. They put them in a van and ask them to pay up to almost 70 euro, which is 1,500 rands, something that's very difficult for this. So they ask them to pay these bribes, and once they pay the bribes, they go away. They go around the corner again, they catch them again. And so it's a game of extorting money from these people, not even implementing the law. So sometimes it's difficult for these organizations to know who is in, who has been arrested. And of course, these people, remember, they have no documentation. So they feel exposed when they are forced into a corner to pay money. They quickly do that so that they continue their life. So these are some of the challenges that these organizations meet in order to get these people out. Because definitely what is next once one is arrested is to be deported. And most of them don't want to be deported because they don't want to go back to the situations that they ran away from in the first place.
And besides, where do you start from? You've not been in Zimbabwe, you've not been in Nigeria, you've not been in your country for years, and you're just being deported. Nowhere to start.
Exactly. I mean, that's the argument from many of these people, that some of these guys have been staying here for, I don't know, they don't have, some of them, clearly, they don't have even relatives to go back to or a home to go back to in Zim. This is where the argument comes from the human rights organizations to say, these guys, they really want the documentation. Find a way of documenting them. Find a way of accommodating them. Because where you are sending them to go, you send them there tomorrow. You use state money to send them across the border. The following morning, they are back here because that's the only place where they can make a living.
Yeah. Now, Jacqueline, from all this that I'm gathering from both yourself and Tuso, government needs to do more. And in your opinion, how are the actions of the authorities inflaming the problems with the current rates?
I think that the authorities are hugely responsible for the reactions of the community on the ground. Because as you can imagine, myself and Tuso, we live among people. And they are obviously a mix of South Africans and non-South Africans. And to tell you the truth, I have never been in a community ever. In the 27 years I've been here, I've never been in a community where I'm largely unwanted. Actually, I've never felt unwanted anyway. And most of the people know where I'm coming from and stuff. And currently what is happening is even a wonder to people that are South African. They're like, what is happening? So I feel that the government, the authorities in general, they need to take accountability for what is happening now, because it is at a stage that everyone can now see that the pot is boiling over, but no one will take accountability. We have, I think it's a worldwide problem. We have the problem of women and children being underserved in any community. So in this instance, take for instance, you want to go into a clinic and get yourself family planning or something like that, for example. If you can't be accepted at a clinic on because of your credentials as a non-national, because as Tuso said, even if you have papers, sometimes you do get discriminated against. And you find that the authorities in that facility, they will not service you. And what happens? Then now you're giving birth in a country that is already hostile to you. I have personal experience of not being able to access family planning. Then you now you have children that you cannot take care of. and the government cannot take care of you or your children, because for you to access the social grant, you have to have papers. You need papers there. So if you don't have papers from the beginning, then you have a child that is not documented. No one knows that child. The taxman doesn't know that child. So there is no ways that you can be in the social system because you are not documented. Your children are not documented. Now you have 5, 6, 7 heads in this square area that are not being catered for, that are not known. The president is sitting there. He does not know that there's so many kids in such and such a place. And we have the situation of unschooled children that are roaming around in the streets. We have a situation of women who cannot even report violence done to them because they do not have documentation. So this is a huge burden on women and children. The same thing that Africa is trying to conquer is happening in South Africa under the legitimacy of authorities allowing it and promoting it to happen. So you are sitting on top of a problem where you have women and children that are going through hell because they dared to flee the country where they were having those very strong push circumstances that pushed them out of their country. So I think that maybe if the government can look at the push factors that make people leave their countries of origin and come to South Africa, that's the number one. And number two, I think that both the government and the community must look at the realities of migration. 100 years ago, South Africa was not like this. Africa was not like this. Europe was not the way it is. 100 years from now, it's going to be different. Migration happens. People will always be pushed to go to a place where they favor. How then does the government deal with it? We might be having an influx of people, but if they are documented, it doesn't make them even more. If they are not documented, it doesn't make them any less. We are still sitting on top of a problem. And for me, it is even harder for women and children because a lot of women come here to be with their spouses. So now if the spouse has been arrested or burned alive or anything like that, we are now sitting on a secondary problem. If the woman is the one that's the breadwinner, then we have a tertiary problem of a child that's not going to be taken care of by anyone. And then we cry about child trafficking. We cry about human trafficking. How many people are really being trafficked if there is no documentation of anybody that we don't want to document? So it's a bigger problem. It's a huge problem. That's why no one wants to pull their heads out of the sand and deal with it.
Many thanks to our DW correspondent in Johannesburg, Tuso Kumalo, and also Nombulelo Jackie Kweni, a communications and media consultant at the Women in Diaspora Association, WIDA. At the Africa Link podcast, we always seek to see how the stories and issues we are dealing with play out or at times even overlap. In Ghana, many of you might remember the ugly history behind the Ghana Must Go bags. Ghana also experienced the same in the 1970s and early 1980s. The country struggled with severe economic hardship, dwindling oil reserves, high inflation, and mounting debt led to a decline in living standards. Many Ghanaians seeking better opportunities migrated to neighboring Nigeria, which enjoyed a booming economy fueled by its oil wealth. This influx, estimated at over 2 million people by the early 1980s, brought skilled labor and entrepreneurship contributing to Nigeria's economic growth. However, tensions began to simmer. The sheer number of migrants strained resources and whispers of competition for jobs and opportunities arose. So how is Ghana today affected by xenophobia? Joining me for this discussion is Emmanuel Benza, a comparative regional integration expert.
Thank you for the opportunity. To be honest with you, Ghanaians are not known to be xenophobic towards other Africans. There's no issue of Afrophobia, and Ghanaians are known to be very welcoming in the ECOWAS region of 15 member states, possibly now 12. Ghana is probably one of the most attractive destinations for those people who are seeking to come to West Africa because we are described as a quote-unquote an oasis of peace. That peace includes the recognition that we are welcoming cultures, and that's why a lot of migrants come to Ghana. Recent studies that I'm aware of, produced by the ECA, United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, looking at issues around free movement, side Nigerian nationals, nationals from Togo, Burkina Faso, Benin, and Cote d'Ivoire as four of the key five nationalities within the sub-region that are residing largely in Ghana. Now, if there were a problem with xenophobia, I don't think these nationals would have lived in Ghana, intermarried and mixed with the Ghanaians as they have. Even the Lebanese community, which Ghanaians complain about privately for a lot of issues and challenges that they, let's say, give to the Ghanaian population, working population, by dint of poor working conditions and so on and so forth, have been in Ghana for decades, some for 50 years, 60 years, and Ghanaians have gotten used to their presence. So when Ghanaians are not attacking them, we accept the fact that they're part of our culture. We may complain privately that there are too many of them around, but we are welcoming of these cultures because they've been the part of the independence. They've been here pre-independence and post-independence. So they're part of our fabric, social fabric, if you want. So short of belaboring the point, I just want to say that if it is xenophobia, as in fear of other cultures beyond the African ones, even the Lebanese, we don't have a problem with them. The very worst we will do is complain that there are too many of them. But otherwise, we work with them freely. A lot of Ghanaians have businesses with some of these as co-owners and so on and so forth.
Many thanks, Emmanuel Bensah, a regional integration expert based in Accra. That's it for this edition of Africa Link. Your feedback and participation makes this podcast what it is. We value your insights and encourage you to share your thoughts with us. Click follow so you can catch all of the Africa Link episodes. This podcast was co-produced and edited by Christine Mwakidero. My name is Josie Mahachi. Thanks for listening. Until next time, it's bye for now.
DW, made for minds.